Welcome to The Comeback with Boomerang Healthcare, your podcast for relief, recovery, and restoration. I'm Dr. Peter Abaji.
And I'm Dr. Sarah Guzet. As doctors, we know healing isn't just about treatment. It's about having the right tools, mindset, and support to move forward.
You can have pain, you might be injured, or even hurting on the inside. With all that you got going on, you can still have a really great life. And that's what we're here for. This is The Comeback with Boomerang Healthcare. Let's get started. I am so excited to have one of my all-time favorite people, guests, and definitely my favorite nutrition expert, Carla Hernandez, with us today. Welcome, Carla.
Oh, thank you so much, Peter. Likewise.
So Carla, for those of you who don't know, has been a dietitian for 15 years, and she's worked in private practice and corporate wellness and in the health technology industry. And she has special expertise in women's health and PCOS and all kinds of interesting things.
Carla, you have an impressive background. I know that you've shared your knowledge in network television, major publications, and you just share your passion with everyone about leading healthier and happier lives. And so we are very excited to have you here. So thank you.
No, thank you for having me. I was so excited for the invite. So I appreciate it.
Well, why don't we dive into, Sarah, why is this, first of all, why this is such an important topic for us in the work, the clinical work that we do. Sarah, what's a typical scenario that, you know, our patients often are faced with?
I will tell you, working with individuals with chronic pain, especially injured workers, something you'll often hear when I talk to them about, you know, how has your life changed or your lifestyle, or I ask about their health, is that I will hear oftentimes that they went from a very physical lifestyle to an inactive one. And as they lost that muscle, they didn't necessarily change their diet much. And they might be, you know, reluctant to do some activities. And so you start to see that creeping weight gain. But along with that, I'll have a lot of patients who will tell me, you know, I've lost a significant amount of weight, or I've lost, you know, I've gained some weight, but things are fitting differently. You know, they'll tell me that, like, I can tell I lost the definition and, you know, the muscles I had. I worked in whatever it was, construction, or I used to go to the gym every morning before my shift at the hospital. And you would hear how their life and their body has changed, along with increase of, you know, type 2 diabetes or hypertension and poor sleep and other aches and pains. And so it's really sad to see, but it's really quite common. And actually, majority of individuals, when they're injured and have been inactive for 6 months or more, do indeed gain weight. That impacts their entire quality of life. And so this impacts many of our patients, and we're so excited to just dive right in and talk about how we can support those patients, not just for, you know, weight loss, but also even for our patients who don't lose weight. It's more about, right, regaining and keeping their muscles and their level of activity and reducing the inflammation.
Yeah, let's start with inflammation, Carla, and tell us kind of your perspective on it and how it impacts chronic disease, including chronic pain as well as other chronic diseases, and how you start to approach that with patients.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel like inflammation is like the root of all disease, right? So no matter what condition someone comes to me with or symptoms, that's kind of like the baseline that we have to address. And obviously with my work, I do that through food, through nutrition, because that's huge. Because if you're eating inflammatory foods, it's just going to further exacerbate systemic inflammation. Mm-hmm. And so you can't necessarily pick the area that you want to reduce inflammation on your body, but you have to do that systemically through many different factors and many different ways. But food is very powerful. And so one of the biggest recommendations that I typically give is to try to minimize ultra-processed foods as much as possible. So these contain, you know, refined sugars. It can be in the forms of sweets. It can be in the forms of snack foods, traditional snack foods and chips. And they have typically higher sugar, higher salt. They have a lot of additional additives and ingredients that we just you know, don't really know like what they're doing to the body. And so in that kind of state, in that kind of healing process, we just want to try to eat whole foods as much as possible to really support the healing process and make sure that their diet is nutrient dense and that everything that they're putting in their body is helping them and not, you know, putting them further from healing.
Tell us a little bit about the sugar and how that too much sugar spikes increases inflammation and how that could be bad if we're trying to manage our pain.
Yeah. So that's kind of related to also like blood sugar management. So when we eat sugar or really any carbohydrates, and it's not to say that carbohydrates are bad. I don't want to put that impression. But when we eat typically carbohydrates, which breaks down to sugar, or if we eat just sugar in sugar form, that spikes our blood sugar. And what happens is there's a lot of oxidative stress when that happens. And so what we want to do to try to negate that is when we eat carbohydrates, not only do we want to choose the right carbohydrates, so carbohydrates that are either whole grains or nutrient dense like vegetables and fruits, but we also want to be pairing them with healthy fats and proteins to kind of minimize that spike in blood sugar. Also, fiber is very important. So when we incorporate these additional nutrients with carbohydrates, with sugars, natural sugars, it can really help to minimize the inflammation that happens.
That's a fantastic tip and a good reminder of finding those balanced meals. I'm also curious about your thoughts with, you know, hydration. I often get a lot of patients asking how much water do I really need to drink? And they're not always so aware or in tune of how that might impact their chronic pain or headaches. And so I'm curious for your thoughts around that.
Yeah. So it's interesting because I'm not quite sure if we actually have like a standard definition of how much water to drink. You know, we always hear about these 8 ounces of water, 8 glasses of water every day that we should be drinking. The last I heard, I think from NIH was about if you take your body weight and you divide it by half, and that's how many ounces you should be getting. I always tell people too, it really depends on your lifestyle. It depends on how much you're moving. It depends if you're healing, right? If you're going through injuries, anything like that. And also just keeping an eye on your urine color is always a great way and an indication of if you're truly hydrated. But I also like to not only just drink water, but also adding electrolytes to that water. And that can be in the form of, you know, a packaged electrolyte product, or it could also just adding sea salt, which has natural minerals in it. So just adding like a sprinkle of sea salt into your water helps that water get into the cells more efficiently to stay extra hydrated.
I gotta say, I like to do really hot, intense yoga. And I lose about 3 pounds of water at the end of class, usually, which I think is a lot.
A lot.
And I feel pretty, sometimes I feel even a little dizzy or lightheaded, you know, towards the end. And for the first time, you know, where I take my class, they were selling electrolyte packages. And so right after class, I go, check that out. So I put an electrolyte packet into my water and I kind of drank it down, chugged it down. And I felt so much better so quickly. It really kind of blew me away.
Yeah. Yeah. Sodium, potassium, all of that loss, it really affects our energy, our mood. And even people who aren't active and aren't sweating can benefit from it. We just don't realize how dehydrated we get when we're not, you know, also taking in that salt and potassium that we need with the water.
Interesting. You mentioned earlier oxidative stress too. I wonder for our listeners, if you could explain what that is and how you approach that with nutrition.
Yeah. So oxidative stress is kind of when on a cellular level, you're creating a lot of stress on your cells, just kind of in layman's terms, I should say. Typically when that
I feel happens, like I've been under a lot of oxidative stress.
I think we all are. We live in a very stressful world and it happens, you know, and it's not just through diet. It can be, through stress. It can be a lack of sleep. It can be environmental exposure that this happens through. There's so many ways that we can really, you know, stress our cells. And so, you know, through diet, one of the biggest, I would say, like powerful responses to that is antioxidants. So making sure that we are eating very foods that are rich in color, that like vegetables and fruits and a variety of them, that is kind of your, really your powerhouse, I would say, for fighting this oxidative stress. So that would be like my primary recommendation. And then there's other ways you can do that as well. So there's a lot of great spices out there that are amazing for helping with inflammation. So
I
things
like that.
Yes, making your food taste good doesn't have to just be, you know, for the palate. It can also be to help the body heal. So turmeric, ginger, cinnamon, all of those are very common in like Indian cuisine, but they're incredibly healing as well.
That's a fantastic tip, and I think also really tangible, right? Because a lot of times we hear about increasing your fruits and vegetables, and I recall a statistic I came across that is less than 10% of Americans actually eat the recommended amounts of fruits and vegetables. And I think it's also a good reminder of, you know, if you can't get all of that into your diet, just also working on the spices and increasing those and exposing them throughout your day in various meals. But I am curious, any suggestions on how our patients and all of us can increase the amounts of fruits and vegetables that we consume in a typical day?
I love this question. Yes, absolutely. So I like to do this with myself too, but when I've worked with kids in the past, I tell parents these secrets too, because it works for everyone, no matter your age. But really the key is to make sure that it is the highlight in your meal, at least half. And if you have to sneak it in, that's fine. So in the morning, if you're making a smoothie, you can take a handful of greens and just shove it in. I love frozen cauliflower in my smoothies instead of ice.
Really?
Yes. It is a great trick because it's flavorless.
What do you mix it with?
Just the rest of my smoothie. So typically like I'll have like berries and flaxseed and some kind of plant-based milk. Some protein in there, and then I'll shove cauliflower instead of ice.
Having a moment, it really is lately.
I didn't get that memo, but that's good to know.
Yeah. Cottage cheese is trying to cut it off right now.
Yes, it is.
Cauliflower is having a moment. So that's interesting. I was thinking about it in a smoothie. I wonder if it also gives it like a little bit of a thickening agent too.
It does. Exactly. So it helps with the consistency. It's a little thicker. So it makes it more like kind of a milkshake, you know, per se.
That is so interesting. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah. And, you know, I feel like kind of using that mentality of just like, how can I sneak things in through my meal? So whether it's like it's a soup or a stew, it's so easy to just throw some chopped veggies in. Greens are always like handful of greens. They just kind of wilt in whatever you're making. So it's just really easy to throw them in, even if the recipe doesn't require it. You know, there's no shame in like throwing in extra vegetables wherever you can see fit.
When you're sort of consulting or coaching with clients about choosing some of these fruits and vegetables, do you take into consideration, you know, like anything about like their genetics or their ethnic background? Does it matter? Like, is cauliflower healthy for everybody, or how do you approach that?
That's such a good question. I absolutely do. More so just out of respect for their culture and what they're going to stay consistent with in terms of, you know, the diet that I recommend. So that is incredibly important when you're working with, when you're working one-on-one with someone. And so, you know, I'm of Mexican descent, and I know firsthand that if I try to tell my parents to eat some kind of American diet, that's not something that they're going to stick with. And I know that, right? So I have to be very cognitive and make sure that I'm including not only foods that they love, ingredients that they love, recipes that they love, and any kind of recommendations I give. And I would do that for anyone in any cultural background. I think it's very important because just like exercise, if it's not something that you like, you're not going to stick with it.
I think that's a fantastic point because, right, the best way to change a behavior is to modify it, not to replace it. And so if they're already cooking with certain ingredients and perhaps you encourage them to increase some ingredients more than others or to make an easy substitution, things like that, they're more likely to, behaviorally speaking, stick with it.
Yes, absolutely. So I do think it's more of a psychological thing.
I would agree with you on that one. I'm also curious if there's any other suggestions that or things, behavior modifications that you have found either for yourself or for your clientele that work really well that you'd like to share.
We bet you're part psychologist, part nutritionist to to succeed with this, right?
Yeah, yeah. Just to incorporate more experimenting. If you haven't tried, you know, cooking those plant foods in different ways, I think that can also change the game for people. Like sometimes they just have had it one way and they just don't like it and they just stay away from it. But if you experiment with whether it's roasting, grilling, baking, sautéing, and finding in different flavors too, like experiment with different spices, experiment with different sauces. It doesn't have to just be boring. And so sometimes I think we get stuck in this rut of like, oh, I don't want to eat plants because they just don't taste good. But if we can make them taste good and we find kind of what really satisfies our palate, I think it's easier to incorporate into our daily life.
Are there any other highly anti-inflammatory type foods besides fruits and vegetables that you would, you know, throw out there for our listeners?
Absolutely. Yes, yes, yes. So the biggest one I would say are foods that are rich in omega-3s. And so we know like the Mediterranean diet is highly studied kind of around this for being anti-inflammatory. And one of the biggest properties that it does have is like foods rich in omega-3s. So we all know that salmon is a given, but I would look beyond salmon. So there's other fishes that are sometimes even more affordable. They're more accessible to people, like sardines and mackerel, herring. They're smaller fish, so they're going to be lower in terms of heavy metals. So all of those are great options. Also plant-based, you're looking at flaxseed, chia seeds, seaweed, algae. Those actually have omega-3s in them for vegans.
I love those seaweed salads that they sell at Asian markets. Is that a good choice?
Yeah, as long as it has algae in it, that's actually why the fish have omega-3 in it, because they eat algae. And that's where it stems from.
Mm-hmm. Look at that. Peter's going straight to the source.
I'm going straight for the algae.
Skipping the fish. I just want the plant.
That's interesting.
I'm curious if there's also any like common supplements or vitamins that are also, you know, safe and evidence-based that can also support this and, you know, be helpful for chronic pain relief.
Yeah. One of my favorites is curcumin. I think there's a lot of evidence to support its use in inflammation. And that's typically what I would recommend for someone if they're experiencing any kind of pain. I take it myself on and off, depending on, you know, how I feel. But as I get older, you know, my joints aren't as nice to me. And I find that it actually does help a lot. So that would kind of be like my number one. But I think just in general, making sure that whether you're supplementing or you have a really good diet, that it's number one, it's diverse, because if you're not getting a full spectrum of nutrients, then that's typically where deficiencies can happen. That's where you start experiencing symptoms. And so, you know, I always recommend people just make sure that you're having a wide variety of foods in your diet.
Why don't we shift gears a little bit? One thing that sort of changed a lot since the last time you and I chatted is there's so many amazing weight loss drugs that have come on the market. And I'm sure you're involved in, you know, what's going on there quite a bit. How do you coach people or advise people on changing their nutrition habits when they're on medications like that? Or do you need to? Or what? How do you approach your nutrition when you're on weight loss medications?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. And I wish more people asked it. to be honest, because of this epidemic we're having right now, especially around GLP-1 drugs. And it's a must. You know, if you're getting on these drugs, I would hope that you're working with someone that can educate yourself on how to start changing your nutrition habits or your eating habits. The number one thing I would say is, because we know that these drugs can cause muscle waste, mm-hmm. is make sure that your protein is sufficiently there, your protein intake, as well as your fiber intake, because the calorie intake is so low on these drugs because your appetite is so suppressed. Every bite matters. Mm-hmm. And so not just focusing on protein and fiber, as we discussed before, make sure that the majority of your foods is whole foods, nutrient-dense foods, because, you know, if you're only eating 500 to 1,000 calories a day, that's all the nutrition you're getting. So
I want to ask you a couple of practical questions about that. I see recommendations for how much, and a lot of people have different opinions, but how much protein we should be eating. Mm-hmm. I see recommendations about how much fiber, you know, we should be eating. But I don't know what does that mean as far as the food on my plate? Like, mm-hmm. however many grams what does that translate to in real person eating food?
Yeah, I know. It's
like, do I have to eat a whole cow every day?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Yeah, it's tricky. And I think there is kind of a level of education that needs to happen, because otherwise it's hard to kind of say like everything is just the size of the palm of your hand, which is not true. It really depends on the food itself. And plant-based foods are going to have naturally less protein than animal-based foods. And the type of protein that they also provide is very different. It's tough in the sense that there's not real like a super, super practical way. But getting familiar, I would say, with what is a cup? What is half a cup? What is like a typical 4 ounce, 6 ounces look like? Just very, very minimal education. But once you understand that, I think it's a lot easier to grasp in terms of how much you need to be eating every day. Because I know the recommendations are all in grams or ounces as they stand. And it's pretty amazing, at least with fiber. About 90% of our population is not eating enough fiber. And that was shocking when I heard that. Even though I knew we were low, I didn't know we were that low. So
I like what you just said about realizing not everything is the size of your hand, right? There used to be that adage that so many of us learned about 3 or 4 ounces of meat is the same as the palm of your hand. But the truth of the matter is, and that's only for certain foods, right? When it comes to fruits and vegetables or servings of butter and oil, you shouldn't be doing it the size of your whole hand. And what I found when I was working with patients and they would do food diaries is how much they underestimated the volume of their food. And so we would use a measuring cup and I'd ask them to leave it out because, you know, that piece of cheese you ate standing in front of the fridge still counts. Even though it didn't make it into the cup of your measuring cup, it still counts. And they quickly came back to me and realized, they're like, oh, wow, I didn't realize I was eating 2.5 servings. And I thought that was one serving.
Yeah, exactly. And that's so great. And that, typically that is also what I did in private practice, is I would have to have visuals of things to educate people and really help them understand what that looks like and how much they're actually eating versus what they thought they were eating.
You mentioned, you know, a little bit about plant-based protein. What are like some really great high protein plant-based mm-hmm. food choices that you would recommend?
Yeah, definitely. Love legumes and beans because you get both protein and fiber in them. I think they're amazing sources of both nutrients, and they provide so many minerals. I think it's a great option for vegetarians and vegans. And even if you eat meat, you still need to be eating these types of foods, right? We're talking about variety. So those are wonderful. Nuts and seeds will have a little bit of protein and fiber as well. One of my favorite sources of plant-based proteins is tofu and tempeh. Tempeh is essentially just fermented tofu. So it's going to have, you know, those probiotics that we all love to help our gut, It's going to be easy to digest, but the protein in those, in the soy-based products are really high.
Interesting.
That's a great reminder, because I think so often when we think about protein, right, so many individuals go to, right, that the animal products. And I think it's a good reminder of some of the shelf-stable options, some mm-hmm. of the, you know, vegetarian and vegan-friendly options that also have a lot of benefit. And I am curious, because so many of our patients, because of their chronic pain and their health, aren't working full-time. And finances mm-hmm. often comes up where they'll tell me, you know, I can't afford, you know, a full, you know, healthy, you know, lifestyle because
we
of
can't
the,
even afford eggs anymore.
So right? I was just about to say, yeah, a lot of us can't, between the price of eggs and organic fruits and vegetables and grass fed and free range and everything like that, it gets very costly. And so I'm curious if you have any suggestions or recommendations for individuals who are still trying to be financially savvy in the grocery store, but yet balance that with a good, healthy diet.
Yes, absolutely. I would say, you know, don't get hung up on organic foods. You know, get these foods in, whether they're conventional or organic. You know, a lot of people get hung up on, I'm not going to touch this vegetable because it's not organic. Mm-hmm. And what's more important is just to get that vegetable into you, to get the nutrients, to get those phytochemicals, to get the anti-inflammatory properties, right? That's the most important. So I think people get hung up on that. Mm-hmm. It's not to say that conventional produce is not healthy. That's mm-hmm. that's just simply not true. So, you know, if that's a price point issue for you, you know, just hopefully that will, you know, that won't be an issue. And then I would say frozen and canned foods are wonderful to have in the house. And it's a great way to preserve nutrients. And it is absolutely okay to eat them whenever you'd like. I have canned beans always in my house. I have always like frozen berries in my freezer. So, you know, these are really simple ways to just kind of save on money, because we know that fresh produce is just more expensive. So those are really simple ways, I would say, to kind of help with that. But obviously eating plant-based protein sources too over mm-hmm. meat and animal products are going to be less expensive. And sometimes that's a good thing, because mm-hmm. again, we're getting variety, right? We're getting diversity. We're exposing ourselves to different foods. And I think all of that is a benefit. So mm-hmm. it's not that it's necessarily a bad thing to maybe choose these foods once in a while or every day. It's just kind of what works for you at that moment.
What about for people who are kind of rehabilitating from injuries or surgeries? You know, they're trying to build their bodies back up. Maybe they got some atrophy and maybe a lot of inflammation from the accident or something that happened. And what's a good approach for somebody in that situation?
Yes, I would say try to get pre-chopped produce. So, because I know, I remember when I hurt my wrist years ago, that was the saddest thing. I could not cook in my kitchen. And I would have to have like my sister come over and like chop things for me. And then little did I realize, like, I could have just simply bought pre-chopped ingredients. So that's a really easy way to kind of also minimize time in the kitchen. But things that are already pre-washed, anything to minimize prep time is really great. So getting ingredients that kind of are already there for you. And then investing in kitchen gadgets that can help. So things like food processors, mandolins,
electric. It's a mandolin. Mandolin. Stop there. What is that?
I love that question. It's the best invention ever. It's actually just like a, it's almost like a shredder, but it's like a slide. And you slide tomatoes, onions, anything that you need to slice, you just slide it through without having to chop. And it just creates these perfectly round pieces of produce for you.
But you have to use a finger guard. I'm just going to go ahead and say
yes,
that.
Absolutely.
Like, number one instrument to turn on me in my kitchen is the mandolin. many a finger cut. So yeah, it's super great. It's fast. You get into this rhythm and you're like slicing cucumbers. And if you're not careful, yeah, but it's a fantastic device. And yeah, for a lot of our patients, it is hard, that fine motor movements or all that prep work, and they get, you know, tired. And so definitely those are some great instruments to, you know, utilize.
Yeah.
So besides a mandolin, what else, what's another good instrument? I'm really learning now.
Electric can openers are great because manual ones are hard depending on the kind of strength that you have in your hands and your wrists. And then slow cookers are life-changing. Slow cookers, you just throw the ingredients in there and you just let it do the work and you really don't have to do much. You don't even have to wash it. You just put the timer on and set it and leave. So those would be my favorite ones, I would say.
I love that. So slow cooker, what if, you know, people with actual disabilities, you know, maybe long-term or chronic disabilities, what are some good strategies to help them? And maybe they're in a situation where they're responsible for a lot of their meals. How would you coach them through eating healthy and navigating that with disabilities and certainly some of the gadgets you mentioned, plus maybe there's some other strategies.
Yeah. Are there specific disabilities that you're
referring to? Well, you mentioned your wrist as an injury. I think a lot of people get back injuries and being able to stand and lean and do things might be a challenge. Some people just have a hard time standing up for a long time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They got arthritis in the hips or knees. And then, of course, the upper extremity stuff. So many of us get carpal tunnel syndrome and, you know, we get numbness and tingling and all these things going on. And I imagine it impacts our ability to prepare healthy meals sometimes.
Oh, for sure. You know, I would say pre-planning meals is really important. So batch cooking and having someone there with you, I think, is really important. So if you have any kind of support or someone that can be there one day a week to help you batch cook for the week, and then you don't have to stress the rest of the days, you can freeze the, you know, the leftovers or whatever it is that you're going to be eating for the rest of the week, and you just leave the fresh food out for the next couple of days. And I mean, that's just, I think, a brilliant way to kind of do cooking throughout the week if you are trying to save on time, but especially if you have injuries and, again, disabilities that may require you to, you know, to really have to think about how much work goes into meal prep. That's a great way to do it. And also kind of choosing sheet pan meals and one pot dishes to kind of limit your standing and your cleaning and things like that can also be really helpful. So really, and then I would say keep it very simple. Like, don't try to do extravagant recipes from the Food Network or anything like that. Just keep your meals very basic, simple. Make sure you have that protein, carb, fiber, vegetable, and, you know, obviously cater it to your palate. But I think simplicity makes life so much easier when it comes to cooking.
That's great advice.
Those are fantastic tips and reminders. And I think, you know, so many individuals, when they're living with chronic pain, sometimes, you know, don't think about how much it impacts them in the kitchen. Right. Until they sit down to eat and they realize their low back hurts from, you know, standing and, you know, over the stove for too long or doing all the dishes, and, you know, their body mechanics and the repetitive trauma on some of those limbs can be really hard that they don't even get to enjoy the meal.
Oh, yeah,
and so I think you gave some great tips and suggestions that I hope people can really apply. I am curious, you know, what would you say are some great realistic first steps for someone who wants to improve their diet but feels overwhelmed by their pain?
Yeah, it's a good question. Again, I would say kind of real, and I know this may not be super realistic for everyone. It depends on accessibility, but really focusing on whole foods as much as possible. It's really as simple as that. I know, like, everyone that's something I feel like a lot of people do say, but it makes a huge difference with pain and inflammation when you choose foods that are not processed, that are whole and nutrient dense. And so just starting there, like really looking at your kitchen, looking at your diet, what are you eating every day? What can I eliminate? What can I, trade this for? Mm-hmm. And just making simple swaps is really important. So don't kind of try to do like an overhaul, in one day, but I think simple steps every day will kind of make the biggest change in the long run. So, if you're drinking Diet Coke, maybe cut back on that Diet Coke, maybe start trading one Diet Coke for a glass of water. Mm-hmm. Little things like that over time will add up. I never like going cold turkey on people because typically it always backfires. So I'm very much in favor of just doing what you can and what you feel works for you and you're able to be consistent with.
Fantastic advice.
Great advice. Sarah, I'm just curious. I've been thinking, we've been talking about some of these changes and things, and I know you have twins at home. Mm-hmm. Is it easy to get them to eat healthy, or is there a lot of pushback? And what do we do about the young ones?
That's a great question. So as you know, children are quite verbose about their palate and letting you know if they don't like something, and mine are no exception. They were great when they were younger, and I did all the, pureeing of the foods and bought the vegetables and made my own. At the time, I don't know how I did that and put it in the freezer and they eat the spinach with the sweet potato. Well, I honestly, some of the food, I kind of feel bad now because I'm like, I tasted some of those mixes I made, like sweet potato with spinach. And my kids, like, they ate it. Maybe that's why now they'll be like, no, thank you. And I've taught them not to say yucky because that's rude. So they won't say it's yucky. They'll say it's not my cup of tea. But we do have a rule in our house, which is you have to try something at least two bites before you make the decision. Like for example, through that method, I now get them to eat seaweed. So they might be fighting you for that seaweed salad, Peter, but they love seaweed now, right? Yes. But one of the other things that I've done is, to your point, a little bit, try a little bit every day, right? And I expose them to fruits and vegetables at every meal. And if they won't eat a vegetable, I have pureed certain vegetables, like I puree mirepoix, which is celery, carrots, and onions, into any sauce I can. So the marinara sauce, our bolognese, casseroles, I will be putting that in every, and they don't know. One of my boys, if he smells just onions and garlic, he'll be like, Mom, that smells delicious. Like he knows something good is coming. And then I have to like, kind of like puree or cut up the rest of the vegetables. My other son is a texture item. I notice it for him, it's textures. So if I cut it small, he'll eat it. Honestly, he's a kind of a charcuterie diet child. He doesn't like a lot of meat, but he loves cheese and crackers and fruit. And so I'll make sure that we do a variety of different colors of fruits and vegetables, as much as we can. But it is tough with children. And you see them going to the pantry after we have dinner and he's like, oh, I want some crackers. And I'm like, we just had dinner. And he's like, well, I wasn't that hungry then. Now I am. And so it's tough to be like, is it because you didn't like the food? You didn't eat too much of it, right? Yeah. And so I also try to get them involved in the kitchen as much as I can. Sometimes that backfires and I have to, bigger mess to clean afterwards. But it's tough with kids. But if they helped, right, make the pasta or whatever it was with vegetables, then they might be more likely to eat it. But I am curious if you have any of the suggestions, because my kids will still crack jokes about broccoli and Brussels sprouts, and that's universal as long as time. Yeah. And so I'd be curious if you have any suggestions when cooking for a whole family. So, individuals don't have to cook 2-3 different meals every night.
Yeah, it can be very challenging. I actually I'm working part-time with kids right now, and I am definitely, it's been a challenge. I will say that. I don't have children of my own, but this is a good learning lesson for me.
How many food fights have you broken up, Carla?
None, thank goodness. Okay. but yeah, they do fight over food though. It's really funny. What I've learned though is I thought this was really interesting. It can take children up to 9 to 10 times mm-hmm. trying the same thing until they actually decide that they like it. Mm-hmm. So offering them a variety of foods many, many times over and just keep putting them, you know, in front of that food, eventually research says that they will eventually start to want to taste it, try it, like it. So I think it's exposure. The more mm-hmm. you expose your kids to a variety of foods and the more you put it in front of them, the more likely they are to eventually try it.
Oh, absolutely. But I also want to point something out. Like we also don't want to push it either, right? So it's more like expose right. it and try it, but yes. we're not trying to be part of the clean plate club.
Yes.
So I never force my children to do that. And so if they tell me, Mom, I just can't, you know, this broccoli is not my cup of tea, I'll tell them, all right, what other fruit or vegetable can you eat? Yeah. And he might be like, you know what? I see there's avocado over there. Can I go have half an avocado? Yeah. You know, and I'll be like, that's fine. He found one that he'll eat and I'm fine with that. And I got to pick my battles.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's exactly what you need to do.
Carla, I think one of our last talking points, discussions for today is the gut brain, kind of gut mm-hmm. body, gut health, microbiome, that whole area. It's evolving. There's a lot of research going on. Not a lot of it is maybe specifically proved on what to do,
yeah.
but kind of give us your take on where things are at and how you approach that whole topic, because we know that there is a connection between our mental health and what's going on in our gut and our physical health, like, you know, our joints even, and what's going on in our gut. So maybe we could kind of shift to talking about that a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. So, you know, I always like to put this out there. 80% of our immune system lives in our gut. I always love that fact, because that really hits home for how much we need to really nourish it and take care of it. And it helps to regulate our immune responses and prevent chronic inflammation. So when it's out of balance, meaning there's more bad bacteria than good bacteria, that's known as dysbiosis, our immune system can become overactive. That can create low-grade inflammation throughout the body, and it can potentially, you know, lead to worse conditions, issues, diseases later down the line. So we really want to be careful about how we treat our gut. Gut permeability is something I think that is kind of talked a lot about. I don't know if you guys have heard of it, like leaky gut.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Maybe explain what you mean by that.
Sure. So it's when the gut lining becomes more permeable, and it can be caused by many factors, including stress and poor diet, infections. And it's typically over a long period of time when this happens. And essentially what happens is certain things start to become permeable to the gut lining, and they can enter the bloodstream and cause a immune reaction. So what we see with that is people start to have more food allergies. They can have more food sensitivities. Allergies can develop later in life. They can have more pain. It can affect their mental health. It manifests very differently for everyone. Almost every individual I've worked with privately has some type of leaky gut, has some type of gut issue, symptom, and it definitely affects other areas of their body. So it's definitely prevalent now, whether it may be accepted by the medical world or not. I know that's kind of like a tough one. When I speak to like gastroenterologists, they just don't want to accept that leaky gut is a thing. but we do have, I think, a lot of science and research showing that it is something that happens.
So you're kind of saying toxic chemicals, bacteria, inflammatory things that maybe we would normally just excrete, you know, out of our system, gets actually into our bodies, you know, into our bloodstream, and interferes with our good health.
Yeah, Exactly. And I think there's a lot of research out there to support that gut dysbiosis, again, which is that overpowering of bad bacteria from good bacteria, it can trigger autoimmune responses. Mm-hmm. And that includes something like RA, right? Like rheumatoid arthritis. So there is definitely research to support that. And the other thing is that the good bacteria that we want to nourish, they're super helpful. They create substances like short chain fatty acids. And what that does is it produces anti-inflammatory effects. And so again, if we have systemic pain or inflammation, those really help to fight. So we want to nourish that good bacteria.
We need Glenda, the good bacteria in our gut.
That's so cute. I love it.
How do you get the good bacteria?
Yeah.
Where can I find that?
So there's a couple ways. So most people are familiar with probiotics, and foods that contain probiotics are foods that are fermented naturally. So things like kimchi and sauerkraut. We talked about tempeh earlier. Mm-hmm. It's a fermented tofu that also has probiotics. And then you can pretty much ferment any vegetable, whether it's at home or if you want to buy it. I mean, everything from carrots to cauliflower to green beans, anything can be fermented. Miso is another naturally fermented food. So those are more of the traditional probiotic foods that we see. Obviously, yogurt, kefir, those are really big ones in our culture. Or more so yogurt, I should say. Mm. Some people are hit or miss with kefir. But those are really rich in probiotics as well, depending on how they're made and how high they're heated, because it can kill good bacteria as well. So those are kind of sources straight for probiotics. However, what I also love people to have in their diet are sources to get prebiotics. And so prebiotics are foods that help to feed your own bacteria and create your own good bacteria. So foods that typically have a lot of fiber in them will typically feed the bacteria in your system so that it can naturally grow on its own rather than being transient. Because when we eat probiotic foods, sometimes it sticks, sometimes it doesn't. Mm-hmm. Foods are much more potent than a supplement. I think we now have seen that probiotic supplements are definitely not as efficient as food sources for probiotics. But we still want to be able to also, you know, grow our own bacteria. And that's where the prebiotics come in.
What are a couple of good food choices that are you would consider good prebiotic things to eat?
Onions, garlic, as we were talking about before, are wonderful.
Oh, the twins, they're looking good. Yeah.
But also just like apples, carrots, like anything that has really great soluble fiber. Even insoluble fiber, but all of those foods, pretty much any fruit and vegetable you can think of, beans, legumes, as we talked about before, are really rich in fiber. Those are also great sources of prebiotics. So yeah, there's so many out there.
This is fantastic. I mean, it's so helpful to kind of really focus on what matters, because so often, right, we're told, you know, you hear a lot of conflicting information about what you need and supplements, and it's good to kind of just bring it back to the basics of whole foods really does deliver, whether it be the prebiotics, the probiotics, the protein, the fiber. And, you know, with that, to your point, you're really having that balanced body and that healthy gut. And so curious if you have any other final takeaways or tips or encouragement that you want to share with any of our listeners.
Yeah, I would say, you know, it's a journey. Changing your diet, your habits is not going to happen overnight. It took me years to learn how to eat for my body. And every few years, it still changes. And I have to readapt. Right. And I have to figure out what's going on now to adjust to what my body needs in that moment. And it's especially true when you're healing and when you are, you know, chronically inflamed and you're in pain. It's a change. It may be temporary and maybe not, depending on your condition. But those small changes will add up to long-term habits. And so I just want to encourage people to just keep at it every day. You don't need to be perfect. You just need to make progress.
Fantastic advice. And for our listeners who are curious to learn more, where can they find you?
Yeah. So I am very active on Instagram for those who have it at carlahernandez.rd. But you can also find me at carlahernandezrd.com. That's my website. I also have a podcast. It's on women's health called Girl Talk Decoded, where we discuss a lot of women's health conversations.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. We were just thrilled that you could be here with us today and really appreciate that.
Thank you.
And, you know, we appreciate all of your time and expertise and everybody who tunes in today on another episode of The Comeback with Boomerang Healthcare. And just want to remind everybody, if you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe to never miss an update. You can also follow us on our social media, Boomerang Healthcare, for more tips, information, and inspiration. And until next time, keep moving forward. Your comeback is just getting started.